So, we said that networks are in the business of offering services, and that, well, the services are data transport services, and that they have two somewhat different ways of going about it, circuit switching versus packet switching. Okay. And as I mentioned, when we are discussing a layered network architecture, we will be referring to packet-switched networks. There are some correspondences with circuit-switched networks, but they're a bit fiddly. Okay. And so I think we all probably appreciate that networks are quite complex entities, you know, stretching across the world, and yet somehow they manage to hook us up again worldwide. We've built up our sort of very basic picture of a network, where we have users, which are really computers, at either end, and they're sending this packetized data into the network, and it's having to be relayed from node to node to node to node. Okay. And so we see that there's going to have to be a fair amount of operations tasks associated with doing that. And again, protocols will specify how exactly we do those operations or tasks and what their input and output are in. But right now, what we're concerned with is how we're organizing the tasks. And they are organized in a layered fashion. So one on top of the other on top of the other. Okay. Now, what this layering does is, well, hopefully split each task up into sort of a, or split the whole task of getting from point A to point B up into a manageable chunk. It allows us to discuss what goes into each portion of the system. It allows it to be modularized. Obviously, anytime you design a system, typically what you're going to do is say, well, we have a number of basic tasks, 10, 15, 20, 3, and then we're going to describe how tasks interact with each other. Okay. And in a layered architecture, again, they interact in a essentially sequential fashion. One task relies on the next, relies on the next, relies on the next. Okay. So, has everybody heard of the OSI model? Yes? No? Maybe? Okay. The only reason I ask is, again, this is a pretty fundamental networking concept.
And it's one of those things you just have to sit down and think about. Okay. And once you've thought about it, it makes sense, and then you wonder why it didn't make sense to begin with. But, again, it's one of those things that's not an integral part of this course, but if you haven't ever heard of it, I would urge you to sit down and think about it. Okay. So, what a layered architecture does, again, is essentially it stacks up your tasks. And once the tasks are in the stack, any task interacts only with an adjacent task. So our example has nothing to do with networks specifically. It's just to sort of again have a look at this idea of layering. So we have a number of tasks here. We have ticketing, baggage handling, gate handling, runway handling, and airplane routing. And at no point will ticketing interact with runway takeoff. Okay. At no point will ticketing interact with gates. The only thing that ticketing is going to interact with is baggage. Okay. So that's the first idea, is that each layer in the stack only interacts with adjacent layers. The next, and so the second idea that we have is that we have multiple entities executing these tasks. Here it would be sort of the airline at one end, at the departure end, and the airline at the arrival end. If you were talking about networks, you'd have the sender, the receiver, and, you know, as we'll see, nodes in between as well. And so each task directly communicates through these layers, but there's also a virtual communication with its corresponding number at the other end. So you have two sorts of communications. You have an actual physical communication through the stacks, through the layers, and then you have virtual communication between the protocols at distributed locations. So, to sort of formalize that, we say that each layer implements a service, and we're not overly concerned with how it's implements that, but the output of that service has to be well defined.
Each layer relies on the service provided by the layer below. And each layer then intends the service for the corresponding remote layer. Okay. And so, in particular, this is where the idea of the protocols come in. The output will be specified not only between adjacent or, well, the interaction will be specified between adjacent layers, but also the communication between remote corresponding layers has to be defined. Okay. So if we think about our airline example, we buy a ticket, and then once we have bought that ticket, we can check our baggage. Once we've checked our baggage, we can load the gate. Once we load the gate, the plane shuts the doors and taxis to the runway, takes off. And at this point, this is where physical communication or transport occurs. While we're there, well, we might have intermediate points. And so as we fly over, if we're going long haul, if we fly over different countries, or even if we fly over any distance, you'll pass from one controller to another at all points, hopefully being in communication with someone. Okay. So we see another sort of slightly more minor point, which is that at different points, you may or may not sort of use all layers of your protocols or all part. You might just go a certain portion up the stack. Okay. And then finally, when you arrive, you need a runway to land on. You unload at the gates. You have your baggage claim. Your bag's not there. And so you go to the ticket office to complain. And we can see the interactions here. You would have to have a baggage check in order to collect your baggage at the other end. And similarly, to make your complaint, you have to show your ticket so you actually took the flight. Okay. So the network architectures are going to sort of run along a similar line. What do we know? Well, we need to physically transmit our data, so it's a very low level. We need to not just transmit bits, but have them sort of interpretable as packets. They don't have to go through just a single link, but they have to go through multiple links. So at some point, you have to decide where they're going to go. And then on top of that, you're not just sort of hooking up two physical endpoints, but you're actually hooking up two entities at those physical endpoints. So there's a number of tasks. And exactly how many is a bit up for grabs. As we'll see, there are some sort of default standards. You could argue that you'd need at least two. You'd need something for sort of handling the users and how the users interact with each other, and another one for, again, physically transporting the bits. But again, this physical transport of bits is pretty complicated, so typically it's going to get broken up into more subtasks. So physical signaling between directly connected nodes, so again, moving a bit from one relay to the next.
digital transmission of messages, so not just bits, but sort of things that make sense, end-to-end communication, and then, again, something to do with the users and what they need to communicate with each other. Okay. And so, again, the actual communication is going to be vertical, so you're going to be going up and down these stacks, except at the physical layer. The physical layer is where, you know, again, physically you move the data. And we say that the two entities running these stacks are executing a distributed script. Okay, so between the layers, we have interfaces, which are going to define the services that the lower layer offers to the higher layer. And again, ideally what you want to do is minimize the amount of information passed between layers and allow for different but equivalent implementations of the layer. So as long as the interfaces are the same, it doesn't matter how you implement within the layer. Okay. Now, data networks specifically add the concept of encapsulation of data. And what this means is that at any layer, the next layer down treats whatever information it gets strictly as bits, random bits. And then it adds on its own segment of information. Okay. At any point, the only thing the layer has to examine for to know what to do is the header information. Okay, and it doesn't need to worry about what the next layer up's data really meant. Okay. So there are a number of layered architectures, and we're going to look at two of them. Really should look at three just to say that there really are more than two. But the first we'll have a look at is the OSI reference model, and this was proposed in the late 70s, so again, as data networks started. And it proposed a seven-layer model. And so at the bottom you have the physical layer, which sort of physically sends bits along. Then you have the data link layer, which organizes the bits into frames or chunks and provides node-to-node delivery of those chunks. The network layer moves a packet from source to destination, so along multiple links. The transport layer provides the end-to-end message delivery and error recovery, so to get whatever sort of service the network was going to provide. And then on top of it, so those are pretty reasonable, but on top of this it has these three user-oriented layers, application, presentation, and session, all of which have sort of specific functions that nobody really cares about. So typically, the network tends to stop here, and then you have an application layer on top, and nobody actually has bothered to implement session and presentation layers. Okay. So, what use is this? Well, it is considered the reference model. But having said that, it's never sort of been implemented as the actual architecture.
Why not?
Well, mainly because in parallel with the proposal of this model, there was a good bit of work done on protocol implementation, and the TCP/IP protocol suite arose from that. And these protocols are what drive the internet, specifically IP, the internet protocol. Okay. They had the idea of sort of layering and services, but more than pinning down the details, they went ahead and implemented the protocols that did these things. And roughly, you can say they have a very similar, or a somewhat similar stack to the OSI model. You've got a physical layer, a link layer. Again, these are left much more up to the individual than was originally envisaged, for instance, in the OSI model. You have IP at the network layer, and so that's what glues the whole thing together. And then you have a number of choices at the transport layer, specifically TCP and UDP, which essentially give you a connection-oriented and a connectionless service. And then on top of this, you have a whole bunch of applications that are the basis for the web as we know it. Mail protocols, HTTP, etc. Okay. So what happens, typically what happens in the physical and link layer, it's a bit fuzzier, but again, as long as two parties agree, that's not an issue. And everybody, again, uses IP at this layer, and TCP and UDTP are the bulk of what's used at the transport layer. Okay. So, again, the way things have gone is, again, TCP/IP would be what's used in practice, and so the application avails of essentially network services through the use of a socket. And what's nice for the application is that's all they need to know about the network. Then within the network, you can again avail of either TCP or UDP to provide connectionless or connection-oriented or connectionless services. IP to get your packet through the network, and then host-to-network or host-to-host connectivity, which again is provided on a link-to-link basis. And so we see that we have our flow of information, we have our application uses the socket to pass the information to the network, and then at each of these stages, the information is handled, again, with the idea of dealing with the corresponding remote layer. So as we go through the network, we have to go for applications, transport to IP, the host of the network at the beginning. Then at each intermediate node, so if we have a switch in the middle, we'll go back up to the IP layer. The IP layer will decide on the routing. Within the network,
They don't care about TCP. They don't care about the application. So they, you go no farther. And then when you reach your destination, you go all the way up this stack. Okay. So, again, in terms of the flow of data, the application starts out with a message. The message is intended for a remote application at the destination. And so as the application passes the message to the network, again through the socket API, the transport layer is going to add information to this message about, again, what sort of connectivity and how to establish that connectivity and how to get the message sequence and write, etc. So all the things that TCP or UDP do. Okay. Then, when the transport layer has added its information, it passes its segment down to the network layer. The network layer just views this as being data, doesn't care. It adds its own header information, indicating what information will be needed to route the message through the network. And then similarly, at the link layer regards all of this just as data bits, doesn't worry about what they are, but adds its framing information. Oh, sorry about that. Okay, and then finally, once all of this has been packaged up, it's physically transmitted. Now, depending on how it's going through the network, and it's the first time I've seen this is actually incorrect, you will go through then different layers. Okay, that's sort of strange terminology, but anyway, if there's no routing decisions to be made, then you merely need to go from physical to link layer and back down again. And again, look up what these layers do and you'll see why you would go up and down. If there's routing information to be, or there's routing decisions to be made, you must go from physical to link to network and back down again. And finally, when you reach your destination, you go through the full stack so that, again, the application, the remote application then receives this message. Okay. So, again, it's one of those things that you just have to think about. If you haven't had to think about it before, think about it now. It won't be examined, but you know, it just makes life a lot easier. If I'm saying the data link layer, you're nodding happily. Okay. So most networks are organized along the line of layered architectures. Whenever we discuss networks, you will refer to what layer you're talking about. And I'm talking about the physical layer, I'm talking about the data link layer, etc. The key ideas are that you've implemented distributed services. So again, there's the end-to-end virtual communication and also hierarchical services in order to sort of get the
actual physical transport. And this is done in a very specific way called data encapsulation. So as you travel down through the stack, what comes down is just regarded as random bits, and the next layer adds its information to those bits without being concerned with the meaning of those bits. Okay. Now, in terms of network performance, sometimes we will be analyzing protocols which are designed for single layers. Specifically, I'll look at the MAC layer and how you can assess that. But equally, you can look at the interaction of multiple layers or how things behave as a whole. Okay, so that moves us on to our final topic. Again, just if none of this is ringing a bell, you probably haven't had a networks course before, and so please pick up one of these books and have a look at it. Our final topic that we're going to look at today is just looking at a few issues about network performance, because this is the reason we're going to, again, start looking at much more sophisticated analysis and simulation techniques, is so that we can say something about network performance. Okay. And network performance can be viewed in two different ways, and I've said this before, but you can look at the network perspective, and it's mainly interested in efficiency and you sort of a global performance, and also from the user perspective. The user doesn't care if the network is wildly efficient if none of its communication is getting through. Okay. And so we'd like to ask questions about both, really. So from the network perspective, what sort of measures of performance would we have? Well, we can ask about throughput, and that's the rate at which packets can be transported through a network. Then we can ask about efficiency. And so efficiency is somewhat related to throughput, but it's what percentage of the network's resources are in use at any given time. And then this is related to the throughput, how many packets can you get through at any given time, but normalized by how long it actually takes to transmit a packet. Okay. And finally, you can look at loss rates. So what percentage of the packets actually get through intact? Now, from the applications point of view, well, they're interested in all of these. They're interested in, they would be interested in a personal throughput. Efficiency doesn't make sense on an application level, but they would be interested in knowing how many of their packets were getting through, what percentage of their packets are in error, how many are lost, what's the average delay a packet experiences, and what's the variability in delay that a packet experiences. Okay. And again, this differs.
which of these measures an application cares about differs a lot depending on what the actual application is. Again, not to belabor the point, but if you have a voice stream, your 64 kilobit per second stream, delay is very important. Jitter is very important. You can't really have variability. On the other hand, you can tolerate loss. The ear will sort of smooth out the occasional losses. If you're transmitting a file, you sort of have the opposite. Delay probably doesn't matter that much, but if you lose a chunk in the middle of a file, your whole file's gone, so loss is important. So the IPUT recommendation, G1010, gives you a good description of that. Again, it's not part of this course, but just if you want a feel for sort of why people care about various things, that's where to look. Okay. Now, as we said before, the implementation of the network circuit versus packet switching essentially is going to lead to different performance issues, particularly, you know, again, if we look at sort of what a given user will experience. So, again, circuit switching, we've set up an end-to-end pipe. We've reserved our resources initially. And so this gives us our first performance measure, a blocking probability. What's the probability that we can't reserve our resources end-to-end? Okay. Now, assuming we do reserve our resources, then things are a lot smoother than they would be for packet switching, but there's still issues. Obviously, your resources will give you a certain bit rate and no more. Fair enough. There's still the possibility of error. So there's always the possibility that bits are corrupted end-to-end. And there's also going to be some end-to-end transmission delay. And onto that, we have to add connection setup. Okay. So what we're really concerned with typically is not the probability of any bit being in error, but the probability of a packet being in error. But obviously, this is related to the size of your packet and the probability of a single bit being in error, where your probability of a block being an error is 1 minus the probability that there are essentially no errors, and this is roughly linear with the size of the block. So you can slide through the calculations if you want. Again, not terribly enlightening, but what we can see is that this does lead to some design decisions to be made. Typically, what's an optimum block size, a packet size? The shorter your blocks, the lower probability of error. Remember we said it was related to size of the block, linearly almost. But on the other hand, you're going to have more overhead. So you have to add all this information for the layers, And if only a small portion of that is data, you're sending a lot of bits to get a small amount of data through. So for delay has a number of factors. We've got our bit rate, which leads to a transmission time. We've got processing delays. We have propagation delays, although the bits are pipelined, so you only take a single hit. And then there's the connection setup. Okay, so again, if you have your circuit set up, you need to generate all the bits, but once they're generated, they propagate through in essentially a train. Okay. Packet switching will lead to a slightly different behavior. Clearly. Okay. And so typically in packet switch networks, the parameters we look at are defined on a per packet basis. So we have our maximum packet size, again to do with sort of handling of errors versus overhead. We have throughput, the mean packet error rate, the packet transfer delay, and so end-to-end, how long does it take the packet to get through, and jitter, so what's the variance on delay. Okay. Now, the issue here is that, again, the lack of pre-allocation of resources leads to unpredictable delays within the network. Okay, so as before, the packet size is a balance between overhead and error rates, and also is chosen to suit the various protocols. Typically, certain sizes are accommodated by certain protocols and not by others. The throughput is, again, how many packets can be transported through the network. And, again, we can look at that from the network basis or also from an individual end-to-end applications basis. The error rate and loss has a number of components. There's one link-by-link basis. We have like for circuit switching related to the bit error rate. So certain packets will just, certain percentage of the packets will just be corrupted. But additionally, you can eventually experience loss due to congestion. So even if at some points the packets are dropped because of congestion in the networks. Again, the transfer delay is the end-to-end time that a packet takes to traverse the network. And there are a number now of components, including two new ones that we were not there for circuit switching, the store and forward delays, and then the queuing delays, the congestion delays. Okay, so as you might guess, queuing is one that we're going to look at a lot in this module, but the idea here is, again, that at some certain points, packets might be arriving faster than they can be transmitted, and therefore they queue and they wait. And so experience, any packet's not only experiencing a transmission delay, but it's also potentially having to wait for additional packets to transmit. And so knowing how many packets are there on average, what the variance is important in analyzing the performance of the network. And as I said before, if too many packets arrive, then this can lead to loss, because only, obviously, a finite number of them can be kept. Okay. So our sources of delay are, as before, processing at the nodes, then queuing time, time spent waiting, transmission time, and again, the transmission time is going to occur at each individual node. And finally, propagation time. How long does it actually physically take to go through the link? Okay. And so, just going back, frequently we'll ignore nodal processing time. We'll just say it's small compared to everything else. Queuing time takes a bit of work to analyze. Transmission delay, again, this is one of those things you should just know, is related, obviously, to the link bandwidth and the packet length. So it's the packet length divided by the bandwidth. So you have so many bits to transmit, and they can be transmitted at a certain number of bits per second. Okay, so know that one. And propagation delay, again, it's a physical quantity. It's related to the distance that the node has to travel, and then how fast can it travel through a given medium. And pretty much there's a couple choices. This would be through an optical fiber, or if you're transmitting down a wire, it's roughly 3 × 10⁸. It's the speed of light. Okay. And so again, the delay is just the distance divided by the speed at which you're traveling. Okay, and again, one of those things you might want to sit down and think about is this, the difference between transmission and propagation. And we see that here, in this example, we have our cars propagating at 100 kilometers per hour, so speed at which they can travel is 100 kilometers per hour. And then at a toll booth, each car takes 12 seconds to exit the toll booth. And so that can sort of roughly correspond to our transmission time. Okay. So the question is, how long until the caravan is fully arrived at toll booth 2? And the answer is that each of these cars has to be transmitted. Okay, and so that takes 10 cars take 12 seconds each, which is 120 seconds or 2 minutes. And when the cars have cleared the toll booth, well, they have to travel this 100 kilometers, and again, they're going at 100 kilometers per hour. So you take a propagation time of 60 minutes. Okay, so both of those components come into play. Okay. Now, again, this is where
You have to be careful. We now have our cars propagating at 1,000 kilometers per hour. So each car is going to take 6 minutes now to propagate. Okay. We also changed the amount of transmission time. Each car now takes 1 minute to be transmitted. And so the question is, will cars arrive at the second booth before all cars are serviced at the first booth? And the answer to that is yes. Your first car will arrive here after 7 minutes, but the whole time to process the 10 cars is 10 minutes. Okay, so what we see here is the effects of pipelining and the difference between transmission time and propagation time. So again, it's one of those things that's worth having a look at if you haven't seen that before. Okay, so again, the delay at any given node is a combination of the processing time, which again we will typically ignore, the queuing delay, which is going to depend on traffic and is difficult to predict, or takes more care to predict. The transmission delay, which is dependent on the packet size and the transmission speed, and the propagation delay, which is sort of how long it takes to physically traverse a link. Okay. So again, the one that we'll spend the most time on is the queuing delay. And so typically you're going to see that it's not really sufficient to just look at averages, or you can't assume that things are uniform, okay? So if you could assume things were uniform, then as long as your packet arrival rate times the packet size over R was equal to 1, you'd be all right. But what we'll see is that because of the variability, the delay you'll experience as your arrival rate approaches 1 actually becomes very large. So that'll be the sort of that's a fairly simple result that we'll sort of explore in this module. Okay. Another thing that will be of interest to us then will be packet loss. And packet loss is going to be dependent on the queue size. So we'll have to calculate sort of how queue length depends on the arrival rates that we have. So finally, another measure that we're going to look at will be throughput. And we can think of this as being an instantaneous rate at a given point in time, or the average rate as time persists. And again, one thing to sort of just work out for throughput is what happens when you have sequential links with different capacities. And typically what you think of is a pipe. You can carry a certain rate. But the limitation then will be on the basis of
the smaller capacity.
Okay. So if you have two links with differing throughputs, then the end-to-end throughput that you're going to get is what is along the bottleneck link. Okay. So here your bottleneck is on the first link. Here your bottleneck is on RC, the second link. Okay. And typically in the internet, the bottlenecks typically occur at the edges, not in the core. Okay, so just to wrap up, if we look at our simple example, all we did here was we looked at the way an individual node or link contributed to performance in terms of delays and maybe in terms of loss, but we made a lot of assumptions about the state, and essentially everything was predictable in this problem. The cars took a fixed amount of time in the toll booth. They all moved at the same speed. They behaved the same. We knew how they had arrived at the toll booth. Okay. The question becomes, what if cars are approaching from other roads? What if they have a number of routes to choose from? What if the time they spend in the toll booth is variable? Then, as you can imagine, this problem is going to become a lot more complex. The complexity has to do with the randomness that's been introduced into the system. And we're going to need to have a lot more sophisticated ways of analyzing these random problems. And this is what we're going to deal with in this module, is how do you sort of handle randomness within the system and still come up with some answers. Okay, and so what's key here is the how we will approach modeling uncertainty, and this is both for simulation and for analysis. We're going to have to characterize our traffic patterns. In some sort of stochastic variables of some sort. We have to characterize our nodes and links as queues, so things that allow jobs to wait and sort of serve them in some random but definable way. And then, of course, networks will become collections of these queues. Okay. So, again, the next few lectures will be working your way towards this idea of a queue. And then, on that basis, we will have a look at simulations. So, how we can essentially
model these queues and run trials and see what happens. And again, analyze what happens, and we'll see what analysis can be applied to that. And also, without a simulation, just writing down on pencil and paper in some finite way, we'll see what sort of results we can achieve. Okay. And finally, we will attempt to get you to compare the different sorts of results and see what assumptions you need to make, when can you make them, what can this be applied to. Okay, so the next several lectures will be taken by my colleague, Connor McArdle, and again, he will start with the basics of probability theory and work that up to queuing theory. So I will see you all in a while. Oh, please don't.